Over the past 6 years, the rate of babies born addicted to opioids has grown by more than 50%. So now mothers, doctors, and the state are trying to figure out how to help them and who should pay for it. Plus, Illinois is the nation's top soy producer, and China is the number one buyer of U.S. soy products. Here's soybean farmer Austin Rinker late last year.
We'll almost export almost 60% of the soybeans will go right out of the country from Illinois that are produced here. So overseas markets for protein is just tremendous, and China is our number one customer.
We'll check in with Austin and a hog farmer about how China's new tariffs will affect them. And
I bet you like to read a lot, too.
Print is dead.
Remember that line from Egon in Ghostbusters? Despite what he says, print still lives in Illinois. How local publications are keeping print alive and redefining what it means to be a magazine. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last month, President Trump announced steep tariffs on imported steel and aluminum, mainly aimed at China. Here's what he said at the time.
A strong steel and aluminum industry are vital to our national security. Absolutely vital. Steel is steel. You don't have steel, you don't have a country.
That audio is from PBS NewsHour. Back then, we heard from members of the steel industry here in Illinois, including the president of the Steelworkers Union in Granite City, who pointed out that 500 jobs came back the day before the president announced those tariffs. But at the time, farmers and members of the business community were worried some of America's biggest trading partners would fight back with tariffs of their own. Well, this week, those fears started to take shape when China announced tariffs on more than 100 U.S. products, meaning producers will have to pay an additional tax to send their goods to the Chinese market. Included in these proposed tariffs are pork, soybeans, and corn. It's a big part of Illinois' agriculture. We're the number one soy producer in the country, and China, by the way, is the number one buyer of soy. To hear more about how farmers are feeling, I'm joined now by Phil Borgick. He's the owner of the 200-acre Borgick Farms in Montgomery County. Austin Rinker is also with us. He farms about 2,500 acres of soy in Shelby County. Gentlemen, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Good morning. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Good morning. Phil, if I could start with you, maybe can you remind us what you farm and how long you've been farming?
I've been farming for over 40 years. Farming enterprise only consists of 200 acres of row crops, but our primary business is pork production. And so we have a farrow to finish operation that raises pigs in Illinois and sells here locally.
Phil, when did you first start selling your pork to China?
Well, the U.S. actually 20 years ago was a net pork importer, and over the last 20 years then, through good trade agreements then with other countries throughout the world, we sell pork to over 100 different countries. China is in or out of our market. Last year, they were number three as far as pork sales and volume. And so it's a very important market for pork when we sell, 25% of our total pork overseas. We need every trading partner we can.
And Phil, what percentage of your operation of your hogs are you exporting then to China?
Well, we actually sell to Smithfield and JBS, and then those are the companies that actually then process that our hogs into pork and then sell to the different countries throughout the world. So we don't sell directly overseas. We sell to the packing industry, and then they merchandise that product to all parts of the world.
So I wonder if you can give us a sense of how worried you are then about the impact on your bottom line. As you've said, you're not selling directly, but you're selling to someone who's selling to China. What was your first thought when you heard China announce these proposed tariffs this week on pork?
Very concerning. So the price I received is directly adjusted by how much pork we sell to other countries. We've had a 3% increase in pork production in the United States. We're looking at an additional 3 to 4% increase this year. And so there's a lot of protein that we're putting on the market. And so it, it is a okay, definitely comes back to my barns and what I'm able to receive for my pork, for my pigs, depending on how much product we sell to China.
Speaking of protein, let's go to Austin Renker. Austin, what about you? You farm soy. I mentioned before that China is actually the world's largest buyer of soybeans. How important is the Chinese market to your operation?
Well, the Chinese market is very important to Illinois. Kind of like you mentioned, we're the number one producing state in the U.S. when it comes to soybean production. But if we were considered a country, Illinois would be the fourth largest country in the world in soybean production. So it's kind of a neat way of putting things in a kind of a framework of how much soy Illinois does really produce. But no, China is very important to Illinois when it comes to soybeans. 25% of our crop will be exported to China, and that represents about $1.75 billion in value. So the Chinese market is a value, and it's our number one customer, so overseas.
Austin, I know you're also a board member of the Illinois Soybean Association. Can you explain to folks who might not be familiar, what exactly are you exporting to China in terms of the product?
Whole beans are primarily what's exported to China. They'll add value to them there and crush them. And those beans are going over there to feed like the largest hog herd in the world. They've got just a growing middle class there within China, and that's all going into to hog rations there in China, the whole beans. They're being crushed for meal, and then the meal go into those rations.
So that's a primary. So you're essentially U.S. farmers, just so everyone's clear, U.S. farmers are growing soy. That's a feed crop primarily for a hog and a pork market, a pig market in China, correct?
Yes, correct. Yep. Hogs primarily and a little bit of poultry. But now demand for soybeans in China has just been huge here in the last 20-some years. They've just got a booming middle class. Just in like the city of Shanghai alone, you could fit the entire population of Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and half of Nebraska would fit in Shanghai. So just tremendous population density and just a booming middle class that just demands more animal protein.
So let's talk about this for a minute. So China's talking about adding this tariff, this tax, to all of the pork, soybean, and corn exports to their country. Phil, can I ask you, who do you think is going to eat? If this goes through, who would be eating the cost of this? Is this the Chinese consumer who's going to see your product in the grocery store for a higher price, or how will this affect you?
It will come straight to the farm level. Through my career, we've had other tariffs, applied to our exports, and it comes back to the farm gate because that product then is a higher value going into China, and so that reduces then the value that they can pay for my pork when I get it delivered to the packer. So those costs will be paid by the farmer.
Austin, same for soy?
Oh yeah, without a doubt. Farm incomes have dropped about 50% since 2013. So we don't really want to add any more uncertainty. Soybeans have kind of been a pretty good profit center for farmers here the last couple of years. While we've been at kind of break even levels with corn, and soybeans have been kind of a bright spot for us, and we really just don't want to lose that market share that we have within China. So we've kind of seen the markets recover a little bit after the announcements there yesterday, so that's been kind of encouraging. But no, we definitely don't want to lose any market share within China.
I wanted to ask you, gentlemen, we've seen a lot of headlines now about President Trump. It's very clear how much support he got from rural voters, from farmers. And one thing that we've heard from a lot of folks, and especially farmers who have told us, if folks have been listening to the 21st, that he said, even though he talked about measures like this on the campaign trail, there was a sense from at least some people like, look, he's a businessman. He's made deals in many countries. In the end, he's going to make the right call. Austin, did you think these tariffs were going to happen?
Yeah, I really don't know here at this juncture. I think it's kind of going to be a wait and see approach. I mean, there's been lots of announcements, and they haven't really put a date on when these will come on if they do. So, I think it's going to be a little bit of a waiting game here to see what does happen. And for ag's sake, hopefully they don't come to fruition.
And are you concerned in the meantime that these announcements give more of an advantage to your competitors? I'm thinking about countries like Brazil, Austin, that perhaps those markets might seize this advantage over Brazilian farmers, might win out over U.S. farmers in this in the end?
Oh, without a doubt. The size of the Brazilian crop is kind of known here at this point in time. And just watching prices there within Mato Grosso, it's just been booming. It's been a tremendous opportunity for those farmers. We've really seen the value of their crop go up here with these announcements. So, you know, China is going to have to come to the U.S. at certain points of the year, just the way the seasonality of it is and their demand for soy protein. But, you know, Brazil can fill some of those gaps. And, you know, farmers have invested so much of their checkoff dollars growing that market within China and developing that market. And we just really don't want to see any kind of reduction in all the work that we've done over there. So,
Phil, what do you want President Trump, other lawmakers in Washington to know about this issue and how it affects you?
Well, that it does come down to the farm gate. We trust our president is a good negotiator. It's concerning to us that we have no control how that will affect us, and we hope that he keeps an open mind and remembers that it does affect a lot of people in rural America when these things happen to us.
That's Phil Borjik. I want to thank you for taking some time to chat with us, a hog farmer in Montgomery County. I want to thank Austin Rinker as well, a soy farmer in Shelby County, also a board member of the Illinois Soybean Association. Thanks for being with me, gentlemen. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Welcome.
I'd like now to welcome back to the program Phil Levy. He's a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He also teaches international business strategy at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Hi, Phil. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Good to be back.
So, Phil, the word trade war has been thrown around a lot. I wonder if we can start by just talking about, are we in a trade war? Is this a trade war of words right now? How would you describe the situation?
I'd say we're probably on the cusp of a trade war. Usually when people, there's no formal definition of that, but often what people have in mind is a series of retaliations and trade measures that sort of spirals out of control. We're not there yet. We've had things announced. We've had, you know, each side facing off saying where this might go. But at the moment, it's still under control. It's a dangerous situation, though.
Right. And so how much of these trade wars, I wonder if you can take a step back for us and just give us a little bit of analysis about how often is it a war of rhetoric versus action? And I'm thinking in particular of even President Trump, who initially, when he announced the steel tariffs, started by saying it was steel tariffs and then ended up narrowing it down and taking out a lot of countries. And really, it just ended up being China.
Yeah, well, you have to address things where they're talking about often in the Trump era or before the Trump era. Before the Trump era, it was actually quite rare for at least two reasons. One reason was that countries had seen what can happen with these kinds of conflicts, and so they had set up a global system where you weren't going to have things that spiraled out of control, and they were quite careful about it. The second main reason is this tends to be really ineffective at achieving your goals. If you attack a country and say, I'm hitting you with a bunch of tariffs unless you give in, most proud, self-respecting large countries don't follow up by saying, okay, I give in, you win. You get the kind of response that we've seen from China. In the Trump era, we've seen more of this rhetoric, and you're quite right. On things like steel, there's often been a disconnect between the initial announcement and then the policy follow-through.
And you said earlier that we're in a dangerous situation, even though we're not necessarily in a trade war. What do you think is dangerous about this? In particular, I think for people who are listening who are consumers, what do they need to know?
Well, there's all kinds of ways we can lose from this. I think you showed this very well in your conversation with the Illinois farmers, that people who have export markets can lose. We can have people losing who are importers. Frequently, you get imports from China that are inputs into Illinois businesses. And if they can't get those inputs at affordable prices, they may be exporters, but they're not going to be able to produce and be competitive on global markets. And I think the other reason it's dangerous is we've done this with a sort of notable lack of diplomacy and a lack of clarity. And those are the kind of things that can lead to misunderstandings and then get us into situations which nobody really would have wanted had they thought about it beforehand.
Phil, we're also sort of seeing, as you said, this kind of tit for tat between China and the U.S. when it comes to tariffs. But I wonder how else could China make life difficult, perhaps even for American businesses doing business in China, instead of just slapping tariffs on things. Is that also a possibility?
Absolutely, it is. You hit it right on the head. They can make, you have an awful lot of doing business in China where, and I should say, by the way, the U.S. has some real reasons to be concerned about Chinese practices. The question is, what's the most effective way to do stuff about it? And one of the problems we've sometimes seen is China can make a promise to be open on paper, but the way it plays out administratively, it can be difficult for American businesses. We've been making some progress on this front. We could backslide seriously. It's also worth remembering that we've been reliant on China to help us on a whole range of things, including dealing, for example, with a very dangerous situation with North Korea. So China has not always been as cooperative as it has been in sort of international affairs, and it doesn't have to be in the future.
So, but it is in China's best interest, obviously. I mean, they're a big holder of, for example, U.S. Treasury bonds. They don't want the U.S. economy to fall apart either, right? So in the end, do you think that that will help perhaps balance things out?
I think yes, and the Chinese have been quite vocal and straightforward. They do not want a trade war. They do not think this is in anyone's interest. But I think there's also zero chance that they're going to kowtow to the United States and say, all right, you threatened us, you win. I think if you looked at the various ways we might get them to change their behavior, you could think of several. This is the least effective you could think of. The more effective way, quiet diplomacy. They came to meet with President Trump early on, and had the U.S. been a little clearer about what it wanted, there was a chance to do things there. The Trump administration did strike an agreement. It just didn't cover the things they ultimately decided they cared about. Also, multilateral diplomacy and things like the TPP, that was aimed at changing Chinese behavior. President Trump stepped away from it right off the bat.
So now we'll see how things play out. I want to thank Phil Levy for being with us, a trade expert who's a senior fellow at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He also teaches at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management. Phil, thanks for being with me. Always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
The 21st is made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, presenting A Return to the Madhouse, Climate Change Denial in the Age of Trump, April 6th at 3 p.m. at the Levis Faculty Center. Professor Michael Mann will examine the evidence of climate change and the reasons we should care. cas.illinois.edu.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've all now heard many stories about America's opioid crisis. Just this morning, the Surgeon General issued an advisory that encouraged more people to routinely carry Narcan. That's a drug that can reduce overdoses. But you may not have heard about its tiniest victims. That's how Crane Chicago business reporter Kristen Schorsch refers to babies born addicted to opioids suffering from withdrawal symptoms. Their care largely falls on resource-strapped hospitals and state Medicare, regardless of whether the mother was on illegal heroin or legally prescribed pain medication. And how many infants are we talking about? According to the state public health department, nearly 3 of every 1,000 babies were born with neonatal abstinence syndrome in 2016. That's a 53% increase over the past 6 years. The rate's climbing fastest in rural counties while decreasing in Chicago, and it's highest among white babies and those on Medicaid, although it might surprise you to hear that 14% of these tiny victims were on private insurance, a sign this isn't just happening to the poor. As I said, Kristen Schorsch has been reporting on this for Cranes, and she's on the line with me now from Chicago. Kristen, welcome back to the 21st. I should mention we'll tweet out a link to your story, which has some really moving pictures. Kristen, thanks for being with me.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Kristen, can I ask you first just what prompted you to write about this issue?
Yeah, so I had done a previous story just looking at the financial toll that the opioid crisis has had on hospitals. You know, thinking about when people are showing up to the ER and overdosing, what that looks like, what that costs. And then I was also just seeing stories around the country about these babies that were born, and just looking at that ripple effect and wanting to understand how that was happening in Illinois.
We're speaking with Crane Chicago business reporter Kristen Schorsch. As I said, if you follow 21ST show, we'll tweet out the link to Kristen's reporting. I want to bring someone else into this conversation as well. Sandy Damon is a neonatal nurse practitioner at Mercy Health Hospital in Rockford. She's at our partner WNIJ in DeKalb. Hi, Sandy. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi.
Sandy, can you tell us about a typical situation for a baby that's born with this, I guess it's called neonatal abstinence syndrome?
Yes, it's the physical symptoms of withdrawal when a baby's exposed to opioids. And as you said, it's whether a mother uses heroin or whether they're on prescription painkillers. And their presentation of symptoms really depends on what they're using. Heroin is pretty fast-acting, and so those babies can withdraw within the first 24 hours, whereas methadone is a longer-acting opioid, and they can start withdrawing anywhere from 3 to 5 days. And they appear like they have a severe case of the flu, except their neurologic symptom is upregulated. So it's very difficult for them to be comforted, to console, to eat, to sleep, to gain weight.
Hmm. That's Sandy Damon. She's a neonatal nurse practitioner at Rockford's Mercy Health Hospital. I want to bring a third person into this conversation. LaTanya Halliburton is a 34-year-old mom who was featured in Kristen's story. She's an East St. Louis native. She's actually on the line from the Haymarket Center in Chicago. Hi, LaTanya. Thanks for being with
me. Hello.
Okay, I wonder if we can start with you. Your son, Zabian, was born on New Year's Day. First of all, congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you.
Can you tell us about your experience in the hospital?
I remember getting there. I actually had to go for another incident. I was pretty beaten up bad by my baby's father, Zabian's dad, and I ended up having cellulitis. Sorry, I have a sore throat, so I sound crappy today.
That's okay.
Anyway, I had cellulitis, which is the infection underneath the tissue in my face. And if you remember the movie with Cher, Mask, it would remind you of that, the boy that was in it. But anyway, when it was time to have Zay, I was in there for the month, December, and my due date was January 5th. They ended up telling me that we was going to have him January 1st, so we was all shooting for exactly 12 o'clock, but the lady across the hall had hers right at midnight, so we didn't get it. But anyway, I remember just after having him being very nervous about what he would go through. I know as an adult what I go through, so I didn't want to imagine what my baby was going to go through. And then when about 2 days hit after I had him, around midnight is when I looked over at him laying in the bed, and he was sweating and screaming so loud, and he was red. And I was just crying for them, you know, to give him something, please. And they was breaking it down to me that basically the mother's love and having your baby skin to skin to you and having the lights dim low and nothing loud around, and just comforting him was like the best thing I can do for him, is what she was saying. But me, thinking in my head, being an addict, there's no way that would take care of it for my baby. I'm thinking he's going to have to be on methadone again or something, you know. And basically, by me taking care of him, just showing him love and doing everything they said, Zabian made it through just fine, and it was very hard. I had a lot of
sounds. Yeah, it sounds really tough. And I should point out, LaTanya, you didn't realize you were pregnant in the beginning when you were using, correct? And then so you were on methadone when you were in the hospital. And so, Sandy, what happens to babies in utero if it's the case of LaTanya, for example? She was on methadone in the hospital. What's happening to the baby if mom is on either LaTanya? Not in LaTanya's case, she was on methadone. She wasn't using heroin or a prescribed painkiller. But what happens to the babies in utero?
In utero, they experience a very similar effect as the mom, depending on what medication she's using. And these medications cross the placenta and then the baby's blood-brain barrier very easily. So they do have similar effects in utero. And then, as she said, when they start going through the symptoms of withdrawal, many babies can get by with skin-to-skin breastfeeding if mom isn't using any other illicit drugs and a really quiet place. About 30% of the babies can manage their symptoms without medication. But there's a large group of patients that still need some morphine or methadone, and then that certainly prolongs their hospitalization up to 10 to 15 days.
We're speaking with Sandy Davin, a neonatal nurse practitioner at Mercy Health Hospital in Rockford. She's at our partner station WNIJ in DeKalb. On the line from Chicago is LaTanya Halliburton, who's been sharing her story of being a mom and giving birth, as she's just saying to her newborn, say, Kristen Schorsch is how we found all of these folks, because she did some reporting on this for Crane's Chicago Business. Kristen, we heard LaTanya talking about sort of the skin-to-skin. Sandy was talking about this as well. What are there prescribed, or hospitals, are there protocols for treatment options for babies when they're born and from moms who are addicted to heroin or other opioids?
Yeah. Well, right, that's one of the issues that I found in talking with hospitals across the state. And there is a state task force to really try and help these babies and get these rates of neonatal abstinence syndrome down. So one of the things I found is that not every doctor tests for this syndrome. Not every doctor is aware of this syndrome. Hospitals have a variety of methods. I did find that most are using the skin-to-skin method that Sandy talked about. In severe cases, the babies can be put on methadone or morphine to help them with their withdrawal symptoms, and then they're eventually weaned off of that over a series of days or weeks. But I found that a lot of hospitals were trying to really take up the cause on their own and look to places like the Vermont Oxford Network, which is a nonprofit that Mercy Health in Rockford has looked at as well, to really pick up some methods to help get these cases down and help the babies recover faster.
Sandy, what's the protocol at Mercy Health? How do you determine, first of all, how do you know what's going on if you don't have a mom like LaTanya who's being very upfront and you're aware of the situation because she's disclosing that? How do you all even figure this out?
Right. You know, we all have more awareness of it now in the last 5 years. And if a mom isn't forthcoming with their history, we'll just watch the baby. And if we do start to see problems with feeding, that they're not sleeping, that we're seeing tremors, we will start to score the baby. And there are scoring systems out there that help you look at all these symptomatologies, gastrointestinal symptoms, autonomic symptoms, neurologic symptoms, and then you score them so we can come up with a more objective score and decide whether this baby can still be maintained on comfort measures or whether we really need to move towards giving the baby a medication. We always start with the lowest dose of morphine or methadone we can, and then continue scoring and make sure that the baby is able to eat, sleep, and gain weight. And if they can't, then we will go up on the dosing. But we do everything we can to continue all those comfort measures along with the medication and try and decrease the duration of medication treatment as much as we can.
LaTanya, how did it work for you when you were in the hospital? What did they do for you? They said this sort of the skin to skin was what you tried to do for Zabian, right?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much that's what I did. I remember just being an emotional wreck at first, and then I laid there pretty much with no top on. And just held him up against me and fed him. He did lose a lot of weight really fast because of him breathing. It caused him to burn calories. He was 8 pounds, 6 ounces at birth, but there was a time when he dropped down real fast to 7'6". And we was very scared. I was a nervous wreck. A lot of prayer and a lot of me loving on him really helped Zabian, because I didn't know what was going to happen. I was very nervous for him and very shameful for what, you know, I put him through. But
LaTanya, can you tell us about you're at a treatment center now. It's Haymarket Center, yes, in Chicago. That's pretty far from your home in East St. Louis. How did you find this place?
Actually, the case manager at the, well, the caseworker, whatever you want to call it, at the hospital where I went to, which is Dr. Shiken's office in St. Louis, Missouri. It's St. Mary's Hospital. She had told me about a few places in Chicago. I actually didn't know I was going to have to travel this far to get the help that I needed. You know, I really thought it would be somewhere down in that area, but it's sadly to say there's really no help down there with women with babies in that area. I had to come all the way up here, and I remember just already being at the hospital for 30 days, and then they called me and said, hey, you know, when you're released, you're going to be going to Chicago. And I'm like, what? And they're like, yeah. And I was just down to do whatever I had to do, you know, to be there for my baby and get myself together, you know.
What's it like for you now? What's life like for you now, for you and Zabian at Haymarket Center?
I have almost 90 days clean.
Congratulations.
Thank you. He is like, I'm telling you, he's the best baby ever. He is so sweet. He sleeps through the night for me now. Regular everything. His weight's up. He's 13 pounds. He just hit 3 months on April 1st. And so far, so good, everything with him. He even got some shots, his regular shot. So it's like everything's going just fine right now. Thank God it is.
Yeah, it's great to hear that. Kristen, how hard is it, as LaTanya was saying about, she had to go all the way from East St. Louis to Chicago. What does the landscape look like in Illinois in terms of treatment centers for pregnant moms and these babies?
Yeah, there's not a lot of places for them to go. Only 36% of counties in the state have some resource for treatment for pregnant women. And this is specifically for those on Medicaid, because that covers nearly two-thirds of the babies who are born with withdrawal symptoms in the state. And if you think about that, if you're on methadone to help you wean off of heroin or another opioid that you're on, you typically need to take that every day. So if you think about, if there's not a methadone clinic within, you know, an hour or so, if you have to cross several counties to get there, that's a huge problem, not only for the women looking to get treatment, but to stay on that treatment. There are parts of southern and western Illinois that are treatment deserts. There's really not a lot of places for them to go.
LaTanya, I just want to ask, as you are sharing your story, which I really appreciate you sharing your story with all of us, what do you want people to know about this, people who are listening, about particularly mothers who've been in your situation? What do you want lawmakers and hospitals to be aware of?
Please don't judge. They just don't understand how it is to be an addict. And to be a woman that's pregnant, I never thought in my life I would ever use drugs pregnant. I had a 14-year gap. I have a 14-year-old daughter, and I never thought I'd be able to have a baby again, and I have. And I really know that a lot of people judge us, and it's so difficult, and it's something I will never be able to explain. But if anybody wants to know what it's like to be dope sick, it's imagine the flu times 60. So basically, even when you're pregnant, you think a woman would just be able to stop because she found out she's pregnant. And I didn't find out till almost 6 months, and I couldn't stop. I tried real hard, but in my situation, in my lifestyle, it was very bad for me. And I really didn't stop using until I was admitted to the hospital. So it's very sad that it took that much, but by the grace of God, I got into the methadone program, and that's helping me tremendously with everything. So,
LaTanya, thank you so much. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your story. Kristen, Sandy, if you can stick around, I want to ask you a couple more questions, but I want to thank LaTanya Halliburton for being with us. We'll pick up this conversation on the other side of this short break.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, hosting the Association of University Press's annual book, jacket, and journal show in the Link Gallery at the School of Art and Design, April 2nd through the 13th. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking about the opioid epidemic's tiniest victims in Illinois. Nearly 3 out of every 1,000 babies are born with neonatal abstinence syndrome. That's numbers from 2016 from the Illinois Department of Public Health. Crane Chicago business reporter Kristen Schorsch has been talking, reporting on this issue about babies born addicted to opioids and the withdrawal symptoms that they face upon birth. Sandy Damon is also with us. She's a neonatal nurse practitioner at Mercy Health Hospital in Rockford. She's at our partner station, WNIJ, in DeKalb. Sandy, I wanted to ask you about something LaTanya was just talking to us about before the break, about the shame that pregnant mothers have in terms of when they're using and when they have addiction problems. How much of it is on hospitals to sort of identify that and work with moms? Do you feel like this is something that kind of ends up being the burden of a hospital when a mother comes in to deliver, as opposed to happening before?
I think it's at both times. You know, one of the biggest misconceptions is that moms don't love their babies. If they did, they wouldn't be using. And that's not true. Addiction is a complex and powerful disease, and that's how we look at it, as a disease. And so we really work hard to help moms understand that we're not judging them, we're helping them treat their disease, and we're helping their baby cope with the effects of this disease, as we do a mother with any other disease, whether it's hypertension, diabetes, or anything else. And I think when we start to remove that and just talk about it, they do realize that they're not being judged, that we're trying to help them, and the more open and transparent we all are, the better the chance of getting them into treatment is, and then getting their baby out of the hospital faster with them.
And for you at Mercy Health in Rockford, Rockford has some of the highest numbers of babies in Illinois that are born with withdrawal symptoms. You had about 65 last year alone in the Rockford area. Sandy, do you have a sense of why you think this is happening at higher rates in Rockford?
I don't have a real sense of why our community is unique in that aspect. We do look for it. We do work hard to identify mothers and patients, and we test a lot. So the more you look, the more you're going to be reporting. Now, not all of those babies are going through neonatal abstinence syndrome per se. Some babies do have other drug exposure that may be getting reported. But we are higher, and we do look closely, and we are just trying our best to get a handle on the disease, treat the mothers, and treat the babies.
Kristen Schorsch, what did you learn about some of the perhaps other contributing factors in Winnebago County?
Yeah, and I was just going to add, too, to what Sandy said. Also, another reason why Mercy Health Hospital in Rockford might have some of the highest numbers of the syndrome is because they also take transfers from about 15 hospitals, and they have specialists that other community hospitals don't. So if a baby is born with neonatal abstinence syndrome at a hospital, you know, 10 miles away or so, or even in Janesville, Wisconsin, they will come to Mercy Health in Rockford for treatment. But yes, I also found that in Winnebago County, the county itself, which includes Rockford, which has been struggling, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is a nonprofit, they recently came out with a new list of ranking counties across the country based on health outcomes. Winnebago County ranked 85 out of 102 counties in Illinois. Nearly 1 in 4 children there live in poverty. A quarter of residents don't finish high school. The unemployment rate is about 5%, which is along the state average. So when you look at just, if you try and figure out what's happening within the county, those are some of the factors too.
And that's, and then Winnebago County has some of the highest rates of ER visits and hospitalizations for opioid overdoses compared to the whole state, correct, Kristen?
Right, that's also true.
So, Kristen, you mentioned earlier there's a task force from Illinois, the Illinois Department of Public Health. They're the ones who are going to deliver a final recommendation to the state. What do you think is going to be the outcome of this work once it goes to the General Assembly in terms of what you think will happen in terms of other hospitals and how they're dealing with it? Certainly, it seems like Mercy Health in Rockford is setting a standard for other hospitals around the state.
Yeah. Well, I think we're going to have to wait and see how the state lawmakers react. I mean, it seems like the state, just as many other states in this country, are taking the opioid crisis very seriously. There are several experts on this one committee that is looking at neonatal abstinence syndrome specifically. And so if they're going to have 3 years of work and expertise go into this, you'd hope that the General Assembly would put some money and some policies behind this to help the babies and their mothers. And just some of the recommendations from the committee are things as basic as just having a standard clinical definition of the syndrome and having a uniform way that hospitals and doctors report it. Because I think the numbers are likely far underreported right now, just because not every doctor tests, not every doctor is aware of this type of syndrome.
That's Kristen Schorsch. Did lots of reporting on this issue. We will tweet that out. If you follow 21ST Show, we'll have it at our website, 21stshow.org. I want to thank Kristen from Crane Chicago Business. Also want to thank very much the nurse who's been joining us from Rockford Mercy Health Hospital. Sandy Damon is a neonatal nurse practitioner. Thanks for being with me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've all heard it at some point, magazines are dying, right? Well, not exactly. Shane Chamavanjakul is part of a new generation of creators that are redefining what a print magazine can be. She's just 20 years old, and she's the founder of Dill, a quarterly food magazine that looks at Asian culture and Asian cuisine in cultural, historical, and political context. The most recent issue, just out, for example, is all about relishes. It's more like a novel than a copy of People. These magazines can often be hundreds of pages long and filled with colorful photos, graphics, and text. Issues can be you can pay as much as $40 an issue, and they're often only coming out a few times a year. Magazines like this also have a very small circulation that's deliberate. Joining me now from our Urbana studio to talk about this new generation of magazines is Shane Chamavanjakul. She's in our Urbana studio. She's a native of St. Charles, a western suburb of Chicago, and she's currently a sophomore at University of Illinois. Hi, Shane. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for being here. On the line with us from Chicago is the magazine man himself, Mike Ulrich from City Newsstand in Chicago. City Newsstand is home to thousands of different magazine titles that they sell at their two locations in Chicago and Evanston. Hi, Mike. Thanks for being here with me as well.
Hi, Nyla. Hi, Shane.
Shane, let's start with you. You had this idea for Dill back when you were in high school, and you launched the magazine when you were still a teenager. How did you come up with this?
Well, I have always been interested in journalism ever since I was a young girl, and I think that passion really, really blossomed in high school. So I was the journalism kid. I had served on the school newspaper for all 4 years. I was editor-in-chief my senior year, and I think you know, closer to my graduation, before I graduated high school, which was like 2016, I had wanted to start a publication of my own. And so it was my passion for journalism, coupled with the fact that you probably say from my last name that I'm from a Thai family. And, you know, eating food and serving food and making food was something that I had always grown up with. And, you know, having said that, I was also an avid reader of food literature, of cookbooks, of magazines. And it was around that time when I was, you know, reading through these magazines and books and realizing that I didn't really see a lot of coverage on, you know, Asian cuisines and Asian foods from the perspective of, you know, home cooks, you know, putting a spotlight on home cooks, on, you know, telling stories about underlooked and overlooked cuisines and cultures from the perspective of like Asians or Asian Americans. And you know, I wanted to have a publication that really focused on that, so kind of deviated away from, you know, celebrity chefs or restaurants.
Yeah, and Shane, why a publication? I think lots of people have the same inclinations you do when they create a blog, mm-hmm. or they have a really robust Instagram account, or why was it important for you to do something in print?
Yeah, you know, going into it, I'd heard a lot that print journalism is dead, that, you know, why not start a blog, or why not start at least an online magazine? But I've always loved the print journalism. I love like holding like a book or a newspaper or a magazine in my hand and feeling the pages of it. And I think, you know, when you have a limited amount of space, like for us, our book is like 125, 130 pages. You know, you want to make sure that, you know, we have that, you know, real estate, like we have space and we want to make sure that we open it up to our curated writers. And you can rest assured that like anything that goes into it is credible and, you know, it's curated. And I think it really makes it special.
Do you think that there's more credibility because it's a print product that you're actually holding as opposed to a website?
I'm not sure it's necessarily like credibility, but I think with print journalism, like we choose our writers and we make sure, you know, they are experts in their field, they're scholars. We make sure that we seek them out and we ask if they can share their stories. And so that's something that we really seek for in Dill.
Mike, we heard Shane saying that she doesn't think print journalism is dead. I wonder, from your perspective at City Newsstand, you guys have two brick and mortar locations in Chicago and Evanston, thousands of magazines. From what are you seeing? How you all have, how's business going for you guys these days?
Well, yeah, the newsstand sales are down about 50% since 2007. But at the same time, the number of magazines has actually increased since 2002. It's up about 2,000 titles. So it's the kind of thing, like people said that television was going to kill the movies. Well, the box office is bigger than ever. People said that pay TV was going to kill television. People said that radio was going to be dead. Well, radio is still around. It's just different than it used to be. It used to be the dominant medium. Now, radio serves a slightly different purpose, but everybody listens to radio in the car. And I don't think magazines are going anywhere either. They may not be selling as many copies, but like you can see, they have more. There's more titles than ever before. And part of that,
Mike, are they? Is it because they are these very niche publications, as we're saying? Are there four specific audiences? Is that what you're seeing has the biggest success at City Newsstand?
At City Newsstand, yes. In general, probably not. But at City Newsstand, yes, because that's what we do. That's what we specialize in. But at the same time, the irony here is that the thing that makes it possible for there to be so many magazines is the desktop PC, which is also the thing that makes it possible for people not to read magazines.
How's that?
Because of the internet. Well, people are on the internet now and not.
So they're seeing it. I see. Right. Okay.
Well, it's not necessarily they're seeing the magazine. They're just on the internet and not reading a magazine. They may not be looking at a magazine on the internet. They may be looking at Facebook. They may be getting their celebrity news from Facebook instead of People magazine. But at the same time, it's a double-edged sword.
Right. So, Shane, we mentioned the second issue of Dill is Relishes. What's next for your magazine? How many issues do you all do a year?
We're a quarterly publication, so we do 4 issues a year. And, you know, as you just said, Relishes just came out last Saturday, and it's been great, you know, getting to share that with everybody and getting to promote it. And so we're currently working on our third issue. And so, you know, in terms of what's next, I think we're just going to keep going as best as we can. I think it's been a really wonderful journey, and, you know, being to share stories with people and being able to put a spotlight on home cooks. And it's been great. It's been a learning experience for both me and, you know, for everybody else.
For all of you. How many contributors do you have?
So we have contributors worldwide. And so Relishes, we have Mike Sula, who is a Chicago-based journalist. He wrote for us.
Food writer. Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. He contributed a wonderful piece on Namprik. And we had we had myself who had did something on chutneys in India, and we also have our Dill Test Kitchen, which showcases different recipes that we had that we had tested in our own kitchen three times.
Yeah, and so Shane, yeah. how much are each issues? How much are they? How much do they cost?
Right now, they're $20.
$20 an issue. The newest one is just out now. Founder and design director of Dill Magazine and University of Illinois sophomore Shane Chama Vanjakul, thanks for being with us.
Thank
I want to
so
thank
much.
Mike Ulrich for being with us as well with City Newsstand in Chicago. They have a location in Evanston where you can go get thousands of magazines. Mike, thanks for taking the time to be with us as well.
Thanks.
That does it for us today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always head to our website, 21stshow.org, for more information about this and past shows, our social media handles. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.